Hi, everyone, and thank you so much for tuning in to the RegTech Pulse. And welcome back to the second part of this episode. As a recap, Hideo talks to us about why law firms should take a risk-based approach to screening. Hope you enjoy, and we'll see you soon. Thanks.
You mentioned something earlier about how these kind of risks and the awareness is needed across all industries rather than just financial institutions. And that kind of brings us into looking at law firms and how they address financial crime risks associated with their clients. And, you know, perhaps I could be bold to say there's some differences in of opinion across law firms as to what they want to do and what they need to do. And I was wondering whether you could give your perspective on perhaps where you think we are now and where you think this is heading in the next kind of year or two. Well, maybe I should be 5 years, 10 years is probably a better stretch of time to think about rather than 1 or 2 years.
Well, you know, I think we are heading, I think we're going to see change in the United States. Now, are we going to have, let's say even in the next 5 years, a EU money laundering directive type situation where lawyers are affirmatively obligated to act as gatekeepers, to have a certain level of financial crime detection, deterrence, reporting, quality or caliber of program? I don't know that that would be the case. I frankly doubt it in 5 years. But I do think that because the United States, as far as gatekeeper regulation is concerned, and I think, you know, there was a few years back, the International Bar Association maintained a list of countries and the types of gatekeeper regulation or AML regulation that applied to lawyers. And it was over 180 countries at that point. Now, here, of course, lawyers are subject to anti-money laundering laws. It's not that you're a lawyer and you get a free pass. We must comply and we're subject to prosecution or consequences when we don't. But as far as the gatekeeper role, the United States is an outlier, not only with respect to industrialized countries, but more broadly than that. So I think that we are coming to a point, or we've reached a point, where the continuing outlier status has become or will very soon be untenable. Now, in this country and in other countries, not just here, there's a very strong impulse in terms of the attorney-client privilege, client confidences. There is a related doctrine of attorney work product that's not immediately implicated here, but there is a recognition that the attorney-client relationship must be preserved. It cannot be interfered with, for example, by government authorities, certainly not as the rule. And confidentiality and that privilege is very important. At the same time, privilege, and that's a separate conversation, it can be misused to shield information that may not necessarily merit the privilege. But as far as the legal profession goes, you know, we've recently had an ABA ethics opinion. This was in April of this year. And it's on the obligation of lawyers. It's a formal ethics opinion. It's not binding, but it's highly persuasive. And basically, this opinion states that lawyers have an obligation to not be willfully blind to facts, circumstances that suggest that a client may be looking to retain that lawyer's services or use the lawyer's services for a crime or fraudulent purposes. Now, this ethics opinion, I think, makes clear that the opinion is simply stating what is already understood to be the rule, right? In terms of a lawyer's obligation to not only, you know, withdraw or take other action when it's clear, has actual knowledge of criminal or fraudulent intentions, but to not be willfully blind. So that's stating what's already legislated, whether it be in the context of the rules that apply in the different states, because we're regulated at the state level here or jurisdiction level as lawyers. But I mentioned that ethics opinion because, you know, I think it's a recognition, and this is, I'm talking in my personal capacity, not as a member of any task force, but I believe that this is a recognition on the part of the ABA that either the profession must act in the direction of gatekeeper or due diligence with respect to financial crime, or someone will take action for the profession. The profession will be regulated at the state level or some other level. And so I think this is a very, you know, it's an attempt not only to address very real issues, but it's also a recognition that it's something that must be done in order to preserve as much what is called self-regulation as possible for the profession. But I don't think that the United States can continue to be an outlier, even with an ethics opinion like this or others like it, for much longer. I will say as well that my personal view has evolved quite a bit in recent months, even, because what I've come to realize is that the current lawyer regulation system, I don't believe at this point, is equipped to deal with the issues of financial crime and lawyers being a point of access to the financial system. You know, the system, I don't think, is equipped to deal with that. I don't think there are the resources, probably not the know-how to deal with that. And so I don't know that as a practical matter, the status quo can be maintained beyond, let's say, 5 years. Now, there is a spectrum of regulation, right? We have the, you have to have due diligence. Okay, that's reasonable. And some lawyers do that already. They will conduct due diligence. There is a requirement of record keeping. And again, some lawyers, large firms, others may already do that. That's their choice and probably a good practice. But then there is the spectrum where we are into suspicious activity reporting on a client or a prospective client. That, I think, is an area that is particularly problematic in terms of its consequences for this confidentiality and the relationship between a lawyer and a client or a prospective client. But this has been, you know, this is the rule in other jurisdictions, including in the UK, with carve-outs for privilege. So that's a long answer. My short answer is, I think we will see change. I don't know exactly to what extent, but I don't think the current American position will remain in place as is beyond, you know, certainly not 10 years from now. I think we will see changes. And we may see voluntary practices adopted by lawyers out of self-interest, out of preserving their own reputation.
And when you say that there's, you don't see the change happening soon, and this is mostly for me to kind of understand this, is it because you feel like there will be some pushback from the lawyer itself or as an interest from the industry in general? Where do you see that pushback? Because there is clearly that distinction, especially with the directive, for example, in the UK, and I know that there's regulations even in Canada as well around this. But do you think that it's from the lawyer perspective or, like I mentioned, as an industry or from another factor?
Well, I think the pushback will come primarily and has come from the legal sector itself, from lawyers as a profession. And of course, when we speak about lawyers, we're talking about lawyers pretty much acting through organized channels such as the American Bar Association or other associations of lawyers. And of course, we will see that there will be alignment, say, between the legal profession position, whether that's as articulated currently by the ABA, and you know, trust agents, trust formation agents, or trust companies that, you know, their business is primarily, or a big part of their business is to set up entities on behalf of parties, whether it be an LLC, a corporation, or some other legal entity. So there will be alignment, I think. And there are other reasons for parties to not want their lawyers to have these affirmative obligations, and certainly not the obligation to make a report of suspicious activity, for example. But I do think we will see the pushback coming primarily from the profession here in the United States itself. And that's what we've seen until this point. So I don't expect that to change anytime soon. Although I will say within the legal profession, there and within the group of people who I am aware of are aware of these issues and active on the issues, there is a pretty, you know, wide split in opinions on this. I think as lawyers, though, we should be careful to take off sometimes our practice area hat. So if I'm a human rights advocate and I have a perspective, someone who is working against in my practice, you know, human trafficking or other objectionable, of course, activity, or if I'm a banking lawyer, right, and I would prefer that the burden of due diligence perhaps be shared by lawyers, and not just by the financial institutions. You know, we have to distinguish between when we're advocating for our client and advocating for the profession, right? I think we have to make that distinction, and that may not always be easy to make. I think we have to look at this as a profession issue and what it means for effective lawyering. But the current situation, the current rule, I think, isn't going to work. And I don't know that it's tenable at this point. We probably need change.
It's, you made a point earlier. It was about rather than it being from a body being out of self-interest for the firm that people do this. And I think that's possibly what you're seeing at the moment anyway. I was having a conversation with someone the other day, and I was asking him the question, you know, what do you think is going to be your biggest pain, and what are you most concerned about as everything going on at the moment with COVID, as that hopefully starts to ease, what are you most concerned about? And his response was, well, I'm director of conflicts. I have to basically approve what kind of business we take on, especially new business. And I'm concerned that this pressure is going to start coming through from certain partners, certain lawyers who need to drive their book of business and grow their book of business, as it's been difficult in the current climate. And I'm going to be put under huge pressure to just accept more risky business as that comes through. And I said, well, why is that so concerning to you? And his answer was, well, I'm responsible for how this firm looks. And you mentioned about the reputation. So I think it's a really fascinating point you made. And it certainly seems to fall in line with some of the conversations that I'm fortunate enough to be having at the moment with these people. And I'm perhaps the smaller firms, or, you know, single person lawyer, it won't ever be a big concern for them. But I imagine you'll kind of start seeing large at the moment already care, but then when you maybe get down to that kind of medium size, it just becomes more of a concern about what does that mean for their firm if they get something wrong.
Yeah, you know, that's a really good point. And I think, you know, you mentioned you talked to someone who's responsible for conflicts. It's important, you know, and a dedicated conflicts professional would be the case in a large firm, right? But it's important to hear not just from lawyers, but from those who are working within law firms or in that ecosystem as well, because there are different perspectives that are brought. And a law firm should certainly be mindful of its reputation, and particularly if it is a larger firm that is dealing in transactions that are of higher value, and there are expectations that this firm is a sophisticated player advising on sophisticated transactions. And whether it's fair or not, if a firm is in the news or is involved in a situation where there is a client, let's say, using a client trust account or some other scenario, that doesn't look good for the firm, generally speaking. Now, it depends on the firm's clientele. The clients may not mind, okay, or they may understand that these things can happen, even without ill intent or willful blindness. But certainly, there is a reputational issue. And frankly, you know, I've talked about, you know, you mentioned the profession acting proactively so that someone doesn't act on the profession, right? But the other outside party that could act could be a regulator or an enforcement authority. Certainly, there can be a case where a law firm or a lawyer in a high profile situation could be the subject of some kind of enforcement. And that, of course, is not something that anyone should want. And a regulator, you know, they know how to pick cases, and they can certainly make a point through one case. And so that's something I think to be mindful of, especially for those dealing in certain types of transactions and where there are certain expectations of their own capabilities as legal counsel.
Certainly. You know, what would you say is something that people should talk more about that they're not talking about at the moment, or you don't see being discussed as much as you think it should be?
That's a great question, Teddy.
Well, there are a couple of things. I'll keep it within kind of what we've been talking about. You know, one thing that I've found interesting for a few years, and it's becoming apparent again, especially actually in the time that we're living in right now, but one thing that I think has been interesting is the private enforcement, market enforcement of ethical or socially aware norms or emerging rules of conduct. So it's not just that the law is controlling conduct, but there is private enforcement. For example, companies refusing to do business with companies that engage in certain objectionable practices, whether that be a lack of, let's say, diversity, or in practices where there is some exploitation, even if it's not illegal, of labor, or practices that are contrary to sustainability or not pro-environment. So we've seen this where, for example, banks have changed their policies on financing certain sectors or certain players in sectors, whether it be in palm oil, or companies requiring certain sustainability practices be observed by their counterparties. And I'm talking about big companies that have the clout, the financial clout, the market clout, to force other companies, other private players to change their practices. And so I call that private enforcement. And in some cases, private enforcement can be more effective in terms of immediate consequences, immediate change, than public enforcement or government enforcement. And this is private enforcement of non-binding or non-legal rules. Okay, we've seen this just very recently. I don't know if you follow, but here in Washington, we have a football team, you may have heard of this, that has a name that many have objected to for years, and the team has been adamant that it won't change the name. And just recently, Federal Express, which is an important business partner for the team, said publicly, we'd like it if you'd change the name of the team. And I think Nike or another private company came out and said the same thing. And now the team is considering it. And the last time they were asked by the mayor, by others, you know, I think there were lawsuits about the name. But we see an example of private enforcement, a commercial actor enforcing a preference or a let's say, a practice where there is some consensus. It's not unanimous, but some consensus around this being the ethical or the right or the desirable choice. That's one example, but we see this a lot in business, and it's very much related to ethical practices around anti-corruption, around just good, sound business practices. So private enforcement of norms or emerging norms or rules, I think, is something that we should be talking about and looking at.
Amazing. Thank you. Well, look, as we start to wrap up, I just had one final question, which was, I was interested to find out, you know, at the moment, what are you reading and kind of what is influencing you, Hideo?
Well, at the moment, I am rereading a book that I read a long time ago, and it's called Race Matters. It's a book by Cornel West, a name I think a lot of people will know. This is a book that was published in 1993, 1994, very short book. Accessible by everyone. I read it the first time, I think I was in high school. And I've been rereading it, of course, given what's happening right now in our country. And it's a very insightful book that speaks about race and race issues in the United States in historical context, the social aspects, the economic aspects. And I would recommend it to anyone who's interested in understanding what's happening right now and getting it in a very short book that packs on every page. I mean, when I went back and reread, I thought, wow, this book is as good as I remember it being, and even better maybe. So Race Matters, Cornel West, highly recommended for anyone who's interested in understanding the dynamics that we're witnessing right now here in the United States.
Yeah, I have personally read that book, and it is fantastic.
Isn't it great?
I second that. Yeah, it is fantastic. Yeah, so highly recommend that as well. Cool. Well, I am conscious of time, Hideo. We've been at it for almost an hour now. So I just wanted to thank you deeply for coming and talking to us today and just really sharing your knowledge. It's been fantastic. And for you listeners who are interested, Hideo, how can people get a hold of you?
Well, the best way is to look me up on my firm website, MassPoint Legal and Strategy. It's MassPoint, one word, PLLC.com. And you can also just Google search for me. There aren't many people that I know named Hadil Abdelhadi. So you probably have a good chance of finding me if you search for me by name. But look up MassPoint, PLLC.com.
Amazing. Well, thank you again for being with us today. And Teddy, thank you so much too for asking some great questions and joining us. So perfect. Well, thank you guys. And thank you, Hadil. Really appreciate you being here. Now everyone has your information. So if you want to get a hold of her, now you know how. Also, if you would like to participate at the podcast or have any inquiries, please don't hesitate to contact us at podcast@acuity.com. And stay tuned for next week's episode around what is the outlook for financial crime prevention with our very own Dal Sahota. So thank you guys so much again, and be safe, and we'll see you next week. Thanks.